from WNYC. This is The Sporkful.
Hi, who's this?
Hi, this is Gray from Anchorage, Alaska.
All right, Gray, what can I do for you?
I was at a Thanksgiving dinner at my grandfather's, and there were these two people sitting next to me, and we were panning the turkey around, and they said, oh, no, we don't eat the turkey, we're vegetarians. And I thought, oh, okay, that's interesting. And we got to talking about it, and it turned out that they do eat the fish. And I felt like I wanted to say something like, that actually makes you a piscivore, or, you know, what's your definition of vegetarian, but I didn't want to be confrontational. And so I was kind of curious, is there sort of a Miss Manners way to address this? And also, I guess I'd be kind of interested in your idea of the definition of vegetarianism, because it seems like a lot of people use that term fairly loosely.
I will agree with what I think you're getting at here, Gray, which is that if you eat any animal, according to the letter of the law, according to the definition of the word, you really shouldn't be calling yourself a vegetarian. Now, and I have a lot of my best friends are vegetarians, and they won't be happy to hear me say that. I mean, and in fact, actually, I've just started hosting this Slate podcast called Table to Farm, which actually I'll talk more about later in this show. I'm co-hosting it with Laura Anderson, L.V. Anderson of Slate, who is a vegetarian, but in this first episode of this new Slate podcast, she eats some shellfish. I support Laura in that decision, but I guess, technically speaking, she's not a vegetarian, you know, the word. But I think that she eats, you know, she's acting in the spirit of vegetarianism. I'll ask her in a minute, because she's going to be the guest today. I think that the reason why, for, you know, in the earlier days of vegetarianism, it was more common for people to say, oh, I'm a vegetarian, but I eat fish. How old were these people?
Oh, they were older, right. Actually.
Exactly. I think that they are from an older generation of vegetarians when fish were kind of considered different. I think, you know, frankly, a lot of it just has to do with the fact that, like, fish are underwater. You don't really see them until they're already dead. And they don't really have personalities.
But I'd almost argue the opposite, especially up here in Alaska. I mean, you know, I personally, you know, was responsible for slaughtering 90 fish last summer in one day, you know, with a club, and I feel like if it bleeds, it's an animal, and it was a little disconcerting to do that. And I think in Alaska, we have that experience.
Right. And so, Gray, in response to your other question about, you know, the Miss Manners way to broach this with them and to tell them that they're total hypocrites without offending them, I would say I would begin by just asking them questions. Well, how did you come to believe this? And oh, why do you think that fish are different? Kind of get, you know, go through a sort of Socratic dialogue with them. I would just sort of ask the questions, well, but why do you think fish is different? I clubbed a fish to death just last week.
Well, I don't think I'd necessarily say that. I mean, it does come off as a little brutal, but, well, again, I just feel like words mean things, and I just feel like you shouldn't use terms unless you really are, they're really applicable, and that's a good way to sort of let them come to their own decision rather than, you know, sort of confronting them with, you know, what are you saying?
Right. I think that's a great way to put it, Gray. And my guest today on today's show is a vegetarian, so I'll ask her for her take on this question as well.
Oh, I would be interested. I'll definitely have to listen.
All right. Thanks for your call, Gray.
Thank you.
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman, and we're about to challenge your assumptions about consumption and drop a sporkful of knowledge on you. Because we're obsessively compulsive about eating more awesomely, and because if history has taught us anything, it's that the hosts of food shows need a lot of catchphrases. Joining me for today's show is my friend Laura Anderson. She is Slate's food and drink editor, and also my co-host on a new Slate food podcast that's called Table to Farm. Hey, Laura.
Hi, Dan.
Thanks for coming back to The Sporkful.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We just had this caller here on The Sporkful who's asking this question. If someone calls themselves a vegetarian, shouldn't that mean that they don't eat any animals? And that was her question. It made me think of you, because you are a pretty strict vegetarian, but you occasionally eat shellfish. And in episode one of our Slate series, you ate some shellfish.
That's right. It was delicious. So I call myself a vegetarian. I stopped eating meat when I was 8 years old. These days, I mostly don't eat any meat, but occasionally, like maybe once a month or less, I will eat some fish. And the reason I don't call myself a pescatarian is because I don't want people to assume that I will just eat fish whenever it's available. I feel like if I tell people I'm a pescatarian, they will just like constantly be offering me fish and like coercing me into eating fish. This is probably a completely irrational fear. And yet this is my fear. And I feel like it's much easier for me to just tell people I'm a vegetarian and have them assume that I won't be eating any kind of animal flesh than to get into that every time I start talking to someone about my dietary habits.
Her basic point was words mean something.
They do. And I'm using the word vegetarian incorrectly when I describe myself that way. But I used to be kind of judgmental about that kind of thing, about describing yourself as a vegetarian than maybe not eating fish. This is before I became that exact person. But like you were saying, everyone is sort of hypocritical in some way. I don't think it's very helpful to be so strict about labels. I think that it's a good thing overall for people to be eating less meat.
I think that's fair, Laura. I'm letting you off the hook.
Thank you. May I make another confession?
Yes.
I was thinking about this. I was a vegan for maybe a couple of years when I was a teenager. But while I was a vegan, I had this exception for myself that every time I went back to Austin, which is where I'm from, I could eat Amy's Ice Cream. Amy's Ice Cream is a local chain of amazing ice cream in Austin, Texas. Does that mean I wasn't a vegan? Technically, yes. That means I wasn't a vegan. But the rest of the time, I was. And any kind of moral judgment that all the vegans out there are passing on me right now, I just feel like, well, what's the point? In the long run, the purchases that I was making, the decisions that I was making were good for animals and for the planet. So does it really matter that I occasionally had a delicious bowl of Mexican vanilla ice cream with hot fudge on it? I don't know.
No, I mean, well, look, you could have, instead of calling yourself a vegan, you could have called yourself an Amy's ice creamitarian.
That is true. I should have done that. But again, it's like sometimes you just don't feel like getting into an explanation. Like these terms are shorthand. Most of the time, other people just don't really care that much. Like most people are probably not that interested in my explanation about
most people stopped listening to this podcast
exactly.
10 minutes ago.
This is right. It's interesting to me because it's my life. It's not really that interesting to anyone else. So,
well, I'll still call you a vegetarian.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
All right. Let's go ahead and jump into today's topic for mastication and rumination, which is ramen. We should say that we're talking about ramen. Like, this is the old school, cheap ass, 25 cents in a plastic packet from the bodega or grocery store ramen.
This is not fancy ramen that you can buy at many, you know, lovely noodle places around New York for, you know, $12 to $15. This is not that ramen. This is like 80 cent.
80 cent? Where are you buying your ramen? I got mine for 29 cents.
Okay. No, actually, the price does vary widely, I think.
So let's start off talking about cooking the ramen. There's a lot of different ways to cook your ramen. You can go with, a lot of people do it in the office. They just take the hot water from the coffee machine, or they do it in their dorm room, and they might have a microwave in their dorm room, and they microwave the water to get it hot enough. Then, of course, you can go old school tea kettle or in a pot. Do you think it makes a difference?
I do think it makes a difference. You do have to cook the noodles. I feel like you can't just pour hot water over them. They will soften some if you do that, but you need to actually apply heat to them. My preferred method is to cook them on the stovetop. Yeah, just boil some water in the kettle and then pour it over the noodles. Cook them for like two and a half minutes.
Pour it into a saucepan,
okay. Overheat, and then cook for a couple of minutes.
I'll call that pasta style.
Yeah, pasta style, okay. Absolutely. Although you don't need quite as much water as you would use for pasta. They
right.
do soften quite quickly. You just have more, I feel like you have more control over the cooking process if you do it that way. What are your feelings on cooking method?
Well, I like my ramen a little bit on the chewy side. Now, you said a minute ago that you feel like pasta style gives you more control. But I would actually say that not cooking it in the pot over the flame gives you more control because it cooks slower. So what I did to try to attain that chewiness is to boil water, put in the flavor packet, mix it into the water, put the ramen in a bowl, and then pour the boiled water over the ramen. And I found that if you let it sit for 3 minutes, give or take a few seconds. You get a nice level. If you want to cook it a little more, leave it a little bit longer. But that's slow because when it's over to the boiling water, you get maybe 30 seconds. The difference of 30 seconds can be a huge difference in doneness for ramen.
That is definitely true.
My slow cook method, I feel like you have more.
Interesting. So you take the steeping method. At no point is the ramen actually cooking. You are simply steeping it in hot water.
That's right. I'll call it a sous vide approach to ramen.
the slow approach where you get to have like, that's interesting.
I've actually been cooking this bowl of ramen for 3 weeks.
I definitely think visual cues are important. I think I prefer my ramen slightly more soft and well cooked than you do. But I feel that when you are cooking it over heat, you can see there's a point where the noodles are no longer in this rigid form. You know, obviously they come with this rectangular block. And there's a point where they lose a rectangular shape. And I feel that exactly at that point is when they are ready. And I guess my sense is that when you are doing the super slow approach, it might be harder to figure out exactly what the point is at which you want to eat them.
Right. Well, here's my question to that, though. Do you stir it?
Yes.
While cooking?
Yes, I do.
Because I feel like... Well,
Do you stir it while sous vide-ing?
Yeah, I fork it. I stick the fork in and just kind of shimmy the ramen strands apart. Yeah.
Once they are no longer in this array of parallel lines, and those kinks at the end of each bend of ramen are no longer visible, I feel that that is the point at which the ramen is properly done.
I'm now realizing that there's a lot of comparisons you can make between ramen and hair.
There are a lot of comparisons that can be made between ramen.
I don't know much about curly hair. My daughter has curly hair. My wife has really straight hair, and she's always like, I don't know what to do with her hair because I have straight hair, and I don't know how to deal with curly hair.
Mm-hmm.
You have curly hair.
I have curly hair.
Is there anything that you can teach us that from you learned from dealing with curly hair that could apply to ramen?
That is such an interesting question and not a question I expected to be asked today.
I know. That's an unfair question to throw at someone spur of the moment. I want you to think about it.
Okay.
And if you
I do. I can tell you. Although this might also apply to straight hair, although I think it applies less to straight hair.
Okay.
If I put my hair back in a ponytail for like a day, if I keep it up for a day, my hair will be sort of like stuck in that shape a little bit, even when I take out the hairband.
Right.
And so I feel like, and after at that point, the only thing that will completely remove that weird kink in my hair is for me to wash my hair. So I think that there is a parallel to be drawn here, which is that the rectangular shape of the ramen is like having a hairband that has forced your hair into a weird bumpy ponytail shape. And only water. The solution in both cases is that only hot water can fix it.
That is so interesting.
Mm.
Have you ever tried seasoning your hair with a highly salty solution?
I have not. Okay, that's the next step.
All right. I want you to do that and report back. That'll be part two. There's another thing that I've tried. You know, you talked about the rectangular block of ramen. I don't know if you ever tried to pull it apart. But they're actually, it's long strands that double over. There's a fold. It's not one block and it's not two separate blocks. It's actually two thin squares that are attached with a hinge at one end. And you can break it apart into two thinner squares.
Interesting.
And one thing you can do is to cook one square fully and then add in the second square when you take it off the stove.
Oh, so you get more than one texture.
Exactly. Nice. Multi-textured ramen.
That is interesting. I actually had never noticed that about the shape of the rectangle, of the fact that there's this hinge. But I have, on occasion, made two packages of ramen together when I'm hungry enough to eat two of them. And that definitely seems like a good approach in that case.
And that gets into, we might as well hit it right here while you mention it, portioning.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's very easy to eat a lot of ramen.
It is. Well,
but also dangerous.
I think the ideal ramen size would be about 1.5 packages.
The one thing that I notice in eating the ramen is that I think it expands in your stomach after you eat it.
I think that's true. I think that is definitely true.
I think that if you say 1.5 is ideal, as I mentioned, there is the hinge. Mm-hmm. So 1.5 is actually not so hard to do.
Right.
You're going to break it at the hinge. The other thing that allows you to do, and this segues us into our next topic of conversation, which is the use of the seasoning packet.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask how you, if you were going to do 1.5 packages, how do you deal with your seasoning packet?
Well, in that case, I would probably, I mean, in that case, what you want to do is to buy 3 packs of ramen and have 1.5 in one sitting and 1.5 for a separate meal, but discard one of the 3 flavor packets.
Mm-hmm.
Because I personally believe that the flavor packets are too salty. And I think that you only want to use, I would put the ideal at 2/3. Two-thirds of the flavor packet. And so one flavor packet for 1.5 packages of ramen would be just about right.
Interesting. You're right. That ratio would definitely match up. But I totally disagree. I feel that a packet is the correct amount. A packet of seasoning is the correct amount for a block of ramen. And I will go even further and say that I think that you agree with me here, think that the amount of water that is suggested on the package is too much. I will cook my noodles and they'll pour off at least maybe about half the water because I don't need that much broth. I prefer to have a higher noodle to broth ratio. But I will still add the entire packet of flavoring to the reduced amount of water, which makes it even saltier than intended by the manufacturers. And yet I think that that is delicious. I don't know. It's this MSG primordial broth, and I can't stop eating it.
I don't know that MSG is primordial. I think its advent
was
a little
more recent.
It's
the primordial flavor.
Of monosodium glutamate.
Yes. Yeah.
The cavemen loved it. God, there's so many things that I need to say now in response to this. First of all, I agree that I don't like too much broth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of the seasoning, the other question I want to ask you is, at what point do you add the flavor packet?
I follow the instructions and add it at the end. And another
you
benefit.
You keep referring to the instructions, Laura.
I
do not read instructions. I'm glad
packet.
We have a packet of ramen right here. You're more prepared than I am. You brought one. I've never been very good at following directions.
Well, it is pretty easy. However, ramen is obviously geared towards people, for the most part, I think, who aren't regular cooks. People who don't have access to a kitchen can make ramen pretty easily. So, I think the instructions are there for a reason because, I don't know if everyone would be able to figure it out without the instructions.
I suppose so. I love that they have a picture of the noodles going into hot water as if just the words that describe that would not be sufficient to explain
it. They're aiming for a wide audience. Even people who don't speak English or don't read at all can make ramen. If you are a child and you're not yet literate, I think that you could still make ramen.
That's probably right. Yeah. The instructions say step one, boil 2 cups water.
Too much.
Maybe 1 cup is fine. Add noodles, breaking up if desired. Cook 3 minutes, stirring occasionally. Step 2, remove from heat. Stir in seasonings from flavor packet. To lower sodium, use less seasoning.
I'm obviously not the only one
who thinks that they bother to write that in the directions.
Right. Maybe someone sued them for having too much sodium in their product.
Yeah.
It is very high in sodium, I will say that. But see, here's the reason I don't add the packet of seasoning earlier is because, like I said, I like to pour off some of the water before I add the seasoning. So I want to cook the noodles thoroughly using my pasta method, pour off a lot of the water, and then stir in the seasoning, which, it dissolves very quickly. There's something magical there.
Right.
It makes it dissolve extremely easily.
See, when I do it with my sous vide technique, I said, I do the packet into the hot water, dissolve it, then pour it over the noodles. In the past, when I've cooked it pasta style, I still would put the seasoning in and cook it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the thing is, if you cook it with the seasoning in the water,
it absorbs
the flavor into the noodles, then you can drain off the broth to reduce some of the saltiness.
But you still have the flavor.
Exactly.
Interesting. See, I just really enjoy the very salty broth, so I want to maximize the amount of flavor packet that goes into the final dish.
I tried to make my own ramen seasoning.
Very bold.
I tried to give it a shot. Now, it ended up being too. You tried some too. What did you think of it?
I thought it was good. I really enjoy the MSG packet that you get in your store-bought ramen. And I think, given how easy that is, I don't know if I would be inclined to make my own at home. But I was also, pleasantly surprised and impressed by your homemade seasoning.
Well, thank you. And mine, I mean, I'm not especially protective. I'll go ahead and give out the recipe right now. This is probably not great for the Sporkful business plan, Sporkful Omnimedia. I'm going to modify the recipe based on my experience that I thought it was still a little salty and too much garlic in there.
Mm-hmm.
I think you want 1 teaspoon onion powder, 1/2 a teaspoon salt, 1/2 a teaspoon garlic powder, 1/2 a teaspoon pepper.
Okay. And this is to match up with a single block of ramen?
That was for a single block.
Okay.
Now, look, it does lack something in the... you're a vegetarian, so you didn't try the, you don't do the chicken flavors.
Right.
But there is something about that meatiness, even in a powderized meat, that's nice that you lose. But, you know, you do still get a nice flavor and a nice aroma with my mixture. And you do end up with a lot fewer ingredients that end in A-T-E,
right,
if you care about that.
How was the dissolving with those ingredients? Did it dissolve easily?
That was an issue. I mean, it's hard to pulverize ingredients to the degree that ramen powder has been pulverized. Mm-hmm. That stuff is like the finest powder you can imagine.
It is amazingly fine.
Garlic powder and onion powder that you get at the supermarket doesn't dissolve so well.
Mm-hmm.
So I just dissolved it as best as I could. But then, you know, it ended up as a sort of a coating on the noodles.
Mm-hmm.
And when it was too salty, all I did was I just dumped the broth entirely, added more hot water, stirred it around, dumped that out, added a little more hot water, and that basically washed the non-dissolved powder off the noodles to the point that it brought down the saltiness and brought down the garlickiness to the level that I wanted it.
Mm-hmm. And the noodles were still flavorful because they had already absorbed those flavors.
That's right. Oh, and this is how I stumbled upon my dual texture ramen technique, is that I was trying to, I only did it with half of a pack at first, and then I was trying to dilute it because it was too salty. And I added in the second pack several minutes later, the second half of the pack several minutes later. And so that's how I ended up with the dual texture ramen, which I actually think is a great innovation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't want to get too sidetracked on matters of taste here, Laura, but I do want to briefly go through the different flavors of ramen. And I want to get your thoughts. You're a vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
You tried out the chili and the oriental flavors. I happen to think that the oriental was really kind of gross.
Really?
I really didn't like it.
I care for it.
Okay.
I enjoy it. It tastes like just pure MSG. There's nothing else in there.
I'm sensing a recurring theme here.
You know what? It's delicious. It makes things delicious. It just tastes like enhanced salt. I guess you kind of get the little bit of oniony flavor from the leek and the onion powder. But my preference is certainly the chili variety, which is pretty much the same thing, only it has chili powder in it. It just kind of tastes like broth with chili powder in it, which is nice. Like, it's nice to have, like, noodles with some kind of spicy broth or spicy sauce is always really nice.
Right. I was more intrigued by the chicken and roast chicken flavors.
Mm, tell me more about what
I did a
difference.
Taste test. Yes. Well, surprisingly enough, you can't really taste the roast.
Mm-hmm.
I actually liked chicken better than roast chicken. I thought that it had a richer chicken flavor. Those are the basic flavors that are available. But then, of course, like I said, you can make your own seasoning. But there's also things you can add to ramen. I will put very high on my list of things to add to ramen, chopped raw scallions.
Interesting. I've not tried that. But that sounds great.
I mean, I'm a sucker for scallions to begin
sure.
with.
And they're a great addition to so many kinds of soup. That sounds wonderful. High on my list is cabbage.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
It's good at pretty much any level of cookedness. Cabbage, delicious raw. It's also delicious fully cooked. I find that if you just stick it in your saucepan at the same time that you are adding the noodles, then it ends up to be a pleasing consistency at the same time that the noodles are done. And I'm sure it would also work with your method if you just, you know, steeped it or sous vide it for however long as you normally do. It would end up to be probably a little crunchier than how I do it, but still delicious. But my feeling is that you should choose maybe one, possibly two additional ingredients. I think once you get beyond that, cooking becomes complicated. You're not going to be able to coordinate the doneness well. If you insist, you could probably pre-cook things and then add them at the end, but that's getting a little too complicated for ramen.
Exactly, and that's what I was going to say. I mean, I think there's sort of an unwritten ramen code, which is that, you know, simplicity must reign. And as soon as you start mixing different ingredients or using multiple pots and pans, you have violated the ramen code.
Mm-hmm.
And you should be penalized, and the penalty is that you need to go to a high-end ramen shop and pay $12 for the same food.
Exactly.
One of the uses I wanted to mention, which I've seen a lot and I really like, is ramen, raw, uncooked ramen noodles as a salad topping.
Mm-hmm. I'm also a big fan of this. I think they have to be like mixed into the salad, allowed to sit a little bit
That's
to
right.
absorb some of the dressing. So I think in that sense, they're ideal, maybe not for lettuce salad, but for another kind of salad. I have a friend who does a broccoli salad with ramen noodles. That's really, really good. But yes, they're excellent.
Kind of in situations where maybe you put slivered almonds into your salad, mm-hmm. maybe you drop in the ramen noodles. And it could also be a way, you know, like let's say you accidentally put too much dressing on your salad. Throw in a handful of ramen noodles. Let them drink the dressing.
Yeah.
Let them drink it.
Ramen noodles are like a sponge. You could probably use them in any situation where you need to absorb excess liquid.
That's right.
Whether or not you are then going to eat them afterwards. You could just use them as a sponge.
Yeah,
you know?
I use them to clean my house.
Yeah, right. I know whenever I just like spill some milk on the floor, I just like throw some ramen down. I mean, it's cheap enough. Probably cheaper than sponges, actually.
That's true. I think that's a great penny pincher.
Yeah.
And actually, that concept of using ramen noodles and salad is what sort of inspired me to want to find a way to make regular ramen with broth in a sort of undercooked way to get a little bit of that texture mm-hmm. you get in the ramen noodle salad topping in my regular ramen.
Mm-hmm. And so, you're happy with the method that you've chosen, that you do get indeed that same kind of slight crunchiness that you have in the salad?
Yeah, I mean, it took a little bit of time. You know, ramen noodles, totally plain, unseasoned ramen noodles kind of have an odd flavor.
Mm-hmm.
There's something, I know you'll find this shocking, but there's something a little artificial.
No.
There's sort of like an inside of a plastic bag flavor.
I wonder why.
I can't
imagine.
It
doesn't make any sense.
You know, when they're in a salad dressing, if the salad dressing is kind of sharp or what have you, you know, they absorb the liquid. They have to absorb something mm-hmm. is the point. If you just want them for crunch, and you're just adding them directly and eating them immediately for crunch with no seasoning and no absorption, then they are not very good. And there are other types of crunchy noodles that are going to serve you much better.
Mm-hmm. They're so good at absorbing flavor that they will simply absorb the flavor of whatever it is that they've touched last. And that means that if you take them right out of the package, it's plastic.
Well, Laura Anderson from Slate, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
I'll be back in 2 weeks with a very exciting show. The great, the one, the only Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, will be my guest here on The Sporkful. So do not miss that show. It's going to be great. Until then, thanks so much for listening. I'm Dan Pashman, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.